In all of these talks, we're going to be talking about things that relate to Aquarius. And with that in mind, we can speak about one of the greatest Aquarians that ever lived, Platon, who we know as Plato, and whose real name was Aristocles. And most of the dialogues of Plato, which are written extremely clearly, but mean something not so clear to most people, most of the dialogues are conversations with Socrates and the most illumined people in Athens in his time. And it's kind of difficult to understand who is who, what part is Plato and what part is Socrates, especially since that was not the intention, is to immortalize Socrates. So it's very difficult to see through that, but the dialogues are worth reading anyway. You're reading all of them now, aren't you? How far are you? About a third of the way? What? Oh, okay. One of the early dialogues by Plato was on the topic of friendship. It's called the Lysis, and it's not one of his deeper pieces. But in the early part of that dialogue, Socrates says something quite remarkable. This is as I remember, which is not very good, from a translation by Jowett. Socrates says, "All of my life I have sought for a friend. I, by the dog of Egypt, I would rather have a friend than all the gold of Darius or of Darius himself." Socrates goes on to bemoan the fact that he doesn't have a friend, which wasn't true because he really had many friends. And he says, "The reason I don't have a friend is because he is so plain spoken. From the goodness of his heart, in true Socratean ways, he would tell people what he thought of them, and he terrified them. He was definitely not what you would call a man who will flatter you." In my own life, I've had a lot of friendships. In fact, most of my important relationships in life have been friendships. I haven't been close to family, and I don't have much family around anymore. And my marriage was very short-lived, and there were no children, but that has even been turned into a friendship now. So the way it works is, I would do almost anything for the sake of a friend, and it turns out that I often do. Now, one of my dearest friends is a man that I see probably at most 3 times a year, even though he lives just a few miles from here. His name is Richard Isle, and it is to Richard Isle that this series of talks is being dedicated. Richard Isle is a magnificent human being. He's tall, he's handsome, he has many things in Libra rising, so he's a real natty dresser. He's extremely intelligent, and he's a very gifted and talented writer and speaker, though he does very little speaking. When he was a teacher at East High, he taught the gifted and talented students, but he also taught the ones that he liked to call the slow and the slippery, the kids that played hooky and got into trouble and things like that. He preferred them. Richard has a vocabulary that is extremely large. I couldn't even take a guess. I would say it's over maybe 150,000 words vocabulary that he has, and he uses it freely, and he uses it quite gracefully. Some of you may know him if you go back years ago. There used to be a magazine called The American Theosophist. And inside The American Theosophist, there was a series called The Adventures of Captain Theosophy. And Captain Theosophy would go to many different places and have experiences, and there would be theosophical reflections on them. And quite a few of the episodes of The Adventures of Captain Theosophy took place in Microcosm Bookshop. Some of them laughing about offhand comments made. It's not because of his virtues or his talents that I have him as a friend. I love him because he loves people. We've never spoken about it, but I know that he spends many, many hours in inner concentration giving loving blessings to people, which is sort of his form of praying for people. In the 70s, we had a group that used to meet at the Campus Methodist Church called the Occult Forum. And we would bring in different people, or different people would give talks on various topics, and that would lead to discussions. As if we needed anything to prime a discussion, we were ready at any and all times. And in that group, the two of us hit on the same idea at the same time, and that was trying to discuss the Aquarian Age and what the Aquarian Age was going to be like and what we could do to fit ourselves to the Aquarian Age. We both had, it was like a small time affair of Newton and Leibniz coming to the same idea at the same time. Only Newton actually had it 20 years earlier. But he never had a chance to develop it, and I did. After several years, I put together the notes for several lectures, and then I set it aside for a few years, and then in the very late 80s and the early 90s, I completed the whole series, and then I came back to it again and added things to it. And this is going to be redoing the talks on the Aquarian Age, because it is a subject that is very important, because the whole Aquarian Age movement has been hijacked by what is called the New Age movement, which is just a shallow, superficial commercial activity. And it has very little to do with spiritual seeking, and it has very little to do with the promotion of what is necessary for all of humanity to evolve and bring things forward. So this is going to be, as they say in that commercial world, this is going to be the new and improved version of the transitions into the Aquarian Age. Now, anybody who knows me knows that I'm talking an awful lot, beating around the bush, and that's because of the fact that I have terrible notes, and even with reworking them, it's going to be difficult because they are notes of a type that I don't use anymore, so it may be difficult. So from time to time, if I pause and get a frown on my face, that's what it's all about. It's not because I'm having any profound thoughts or anything like that. It's going to take us 2 years, I think. It's going to be about 25 talks, and if necessary, I will run in the second year into summer in order to get it done in 2 years. All of the talks will be from 45 minutes to 120 minutes long, unless somebody has a pistol. I'll try to make the presentation as clear as possible, and I'll try to not be too tedious. But these talks are not as deep as I would always like to go into things, so that will also be a thing that is a consideration as to the quality of the talks. If there are all of they're of uneven quality and they are of uneven depth, the talk tonight and the talk next week, the talk on altruism and the very last talk are probably the best as far as really worthwhile material. The talk this evening is of modest length, and it is, what is the Aquarian Age? Or when is the Aquarian Age? It's a matter of time. When is it? Because there's a lot of thought about this. The talk is somewhat technical tonight. We're going to talk about some things from astronomy and physics and history and all kinds of things. And the subject is controversial as to when the Aquarian Age actually begins. And so this is going to have a definite slant, but I will recognize and I will respect the fact that there are other views, even if I happen to think they're stupid. I have encountered at least one astrologer, and he was a noted astrologer, that seemed to think that the Aquarian Age began on the day that he was born. And this kind of thing is not uncommon. In history, we're going to be talking a lot about history tonight. There have been various thoughts about what is important in history. For example, some historians have thought that it was the times that were important. This had to happen and that had to happen before it could converge and you would have this very important era of history. Other historians have thought it was the place that was important. For example, Egypt, which had abundant agricultural resources from the flooding of the Nile, was a very rich place, and their culture could develop like no other place. And then some people think that it is a person that is important, that along comes a Hitler or somebody like that. Well, most historians now are pretty syncretic about it. They think that times and places and people are all important, though some have one bias over another. Now, about the time that these notes for these talks were being made, it was a sort of a heyday in Madison. David Spangler, the philosopher from the Findhorn community, was in town. Quite a few of the Findhorn community people moved here before moving to Oregon. I think David Spangler, you don't hear much from him now, and I think he's become an anthroposophist. He was living here, and he was giving lectures. And then one of the board members of the Geocosmic Research Society was living in town also. Now, I never got to meet David Spangler, and I never got to hear any of his talks, because his talks were offered at the same time on the same day as I was giving talks. But in one of his talks, he says, after all the earth changes and all the calamities are over, Madison is going to be the capital of the Aquarian Age. And I don't know that whether that is because he was living in Madison or not. It's close to what Rudolf Steiner says, and Rudolf Steiner says that the center of big interest after all of that happens would be northwest of Chicago, which of course the Theosophists think is where the Theosophical Society is. The Geocosmic board member proclaimed that in 1980 that the first conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn in an airy sign was the beginning of the Aquarian Age. Right then it began. Which indicates how little he had actually studied the Aquarian Age. And not wanting to be outshone by these two luminaries, I figured that since the place was already selected and the time was already selected, it just had to be the person. So I declared myself the king of the Aquarian Age. Through the grapevine, it got to the other two of them who were not happy about it, especially the man that was with the Geocosmic Society. We're going to be a little bit more reasonable and not make any proclamations like that. All right, now we're can actually begin in earnest. If I go like this, or if I go like this, you know what I'm meaning. They are gestures or movement that convey meaning. They are a very specialized body language. Now, all mystics, Christian mystics included, know that everything that exists lives. Everything is alive. And that's a very important fact for any kind of spiritual endeavor. There is nothing dead anywhere in the universe. And all mystics, through their investigations, have found that life is not static. It's active. And that everything that lives moves or changes in some way or another. Nothing stands still in the cosmos. Everything changes, everything moves. Another thing that mystics also know is that everything that lives and moves has some degree of consciousness. There is nothing that is completely unconscious anywhere in the cosmos. Now, what is not always understood is that there is an intimate association, a correlation between these three facts, that everything is alive and that everything moves and changes and that the moving and changing has something to do with the consciousness. So there is that kind of a relationship. Even though some of the things that move, it seems strange that they have meaning. For example, if a vortex is spinning or if an atom is spinning, to think that that indicates some kind of consciousness is kind of a strange idea to many people. We all know from our studies about clairvoyance that people have vortices in their desire body auras, and that if it's really well defined and spinning one way, it means one kind of consciousness, and if it's spinning another way, it means another kind of consciousness. This is literally what is being talked about in the book of Revelation when it talks about the mark of the beast in the forehead or the mark of the lamb in the forehead. It's talking about what's taking place in the interpenetration of the desire body into the physical. Now, body language or gestures, we recognize, have meaning. But things that are more mechanical, it's not quite so obvious that there is meaning to them. And it's also not obvious that there is a bidirectional relationship, that the movement affects the consciousness and the consciousness affects the movement. The idea that movement affects the consciousness of planets, or that planets affect the consciousness affects the movements of the planets, would be considered absurd. It's called animatism by philosophers who like to scoff at it. Now, we can clearly see the relationship of consciousness causing movement if we look at something like dance. We can see that consciousness causes change by watching plants because they move by growing, they change. But it's not always so easy to see that motion, just pure motion in itself, produces consciousness. If you take a walk in the woods, it's a lovely, beautiful thing to do, but you don't see everything. But if you sit and you don't move, after a few minutes, you'll see a squirrel in a tree start to move. He was sitting still because he knew that if he moved, you would be conscious of him, which is exactly what happens after a little while. Movement awakens consciousness. where movement produces consciousness. So you might say, in a way, that even movement itself is a kind of awakened consciousness. Now, these are really simple examples. If we talk about dance, or if we talk about animals in the woods, it's time to look a little bit more deeply at this. Let's look at motion and change in another way, and let's go back to Plato. Plato, in his dialogues, describes two different kinds of change. One is change within itself. And change within itself is something like spinning. It doesn't affect anything outside of itself. It just is in place spinning. Or growing. Or maturing. There are changes and they happen within something and not necessarily as a result of something outside. Obviously, the other kind of motion that he speaks of is change with regard to something external. And that's something like proper motion, like running or something like that. Or standing in water and seeing waves run onto you, something coming from without. Now, if we take fairly modern physics, relativity, for example, the source of motion isn't important. The relationship between two objects is important, but the source of the motion isn't important. It doesn't make any difference whether we're walking toward the church or whether the church is walking toward us. According to mysticism, it is important where the motion originates and what comes of it. In fact, the entire cosmos is based on these kinds of motions. Wave motion, in the beginning was the word, is the way it is poetically said in the Bible, and spinning in place. Atoms or points in space that are the focus of the a divine being that causes the creation, their spinning and their angle of spin is what determines what kind of state of reality they will be expressing. It's a very deep subject, and I don't want to go into it really deeply because it will take us way away. So each of these motions, the motion in place or motion relative to an external object, has a kind of stance, or it has a kind of posture to it. The first type is likely to be internal. It's likely to be subjective. The other is more likely to be impersonal. It's more likely to be objective. It involves something beyond the person. Now, in reality, the two types of motion do overlap. They affect each other because spinning in place causes greater attractivity and therefore things are drawn more clearly to you. And changes without, the more you experience changes from without relative to things beyond yourself, the more one changes in terms of internal consciousness. So they're not isolated from each other. But each has a very different kind of meaning. Now, these are, again, really simple ideas presented in an almost embarrassingly simplistic way, but they are universal. And they are things that can be applied to understanding our lives and to actually living our lives. And by combining them and understanding them, we can make a lot of sense out of the chaos of not understanding that we have of the world. It seems a blessing to us that we are sometimes unconscious of what's going on because we couldn't bear to keep in mind all of what's going on. They're talking now about this accelerator that they're building, where they're going to be just 10 miles an hour short of moving particles from the speed of light. Well, actually, if you think about it, right now we're going through all kinds of motions, and each one has a different meaning, and we can't keep track of them. If you think of it, we're on the Earth, and the Earth is spinning. And the Earth has its proper movement in the orbit. So we have that. And then we have the whole solar system itself is spinning. And the whole solar system has its proper motion in its orbit on the galactic arm. The galactic arm has its movement, and the whole galaxy has its movement. So whether we know it or not, we're partaking of all of these movements, and they are, according to the way that they were stated, each one is faster than the other. And so we're going through very, very rapid motion right now. Now, let's start making charts and things like that. Let's look at the type of movement. And using Plato's ideas, we have the kind of movement. And we have axial. And we have, that's diurnal. We're talking about the Earth now. And we have proper motion, which is the orbital. This is rotation. This is orbital revolution. The apparent cause, we'll stick with what physics says, and we'll give what mysticism also says. What physics says, according to the nebular hypothesis, is it is due to the cosmological force from when it was first started. Mysticism claims it is due to concentration, that at the center of the Earth there is a very concentrated consciousness. This is proper motion is due to cosmic thrust. According to the physicists, the rotation of the planets is sort of like an eddy in a stream, and this is the stream, and the stream is due to the whole solar system being spun. And this is the overall consciousness. Well, I'm going to have to be careful here because I got more things to go on. The natural effect. Night and day. The natural effect here, changes of seasons. The single effect on consciousness. Circadian rhythms. Some people are day people, some people are night people, but everybody has their own 24 hour. Here it's introverting or extroverting. Outside was obvious. We're outside more in the summer, and inwardly, we're more inward in winter time. the astrological effect is that this produces the astrological houses, the mundane houses. The proper emotion produces the astrological signs. Okay, fairly simple. It's actually due to the longitude. Now, we're not going to be talking very much about the houses or the signs. Instead, we're going to be talking about yet a third kind of motion from these two types of motions, and we'll put up all the figures for that in just a little bit. It is, we're getting to the topic we want to get to. Now, the Earth, when we see it, you know, if you see mountains and you see that it goes down for miles of hard stone, it seems that the crust of the Earth is hard and brittle. But the Earth actually is not. The interior of the Earth is quite fluidic, and the crust bends much more than we give it credit for. Now, the Earth is not a sphere. Now we start getting into something that requires a little bit of explanation. Normally, people consider the Earth to be a sphere, but it really isn't. It is called a problate ellipsoid, but it is not even perfectly a problate ellipsoid. It is a lumpy problate ellipsoid. But the thing of it is, because it is so fluid and because it is spinning, what happens is the fluidic part causes the Earth to actually bulge, and it causes the poles to be flattened. Now, this is marked extremely so that you can see that, and that is what the shape of the Earth is like. All right. It is called centripetal force, the force that causes the fluidic part to try to push outward and to be thrown out into space. Now, the Earth is tilted on its axis. We'll come to that a little bit more in a little bit. But at the equator of the Earth, the moon goes around the Earth, but it doesn't go right around the equator. It is at an angle to it. So what happens is that as the moon is coming to the point where it would be right on the equator, its gravitational effect is greater on the bulge, because that's more prominent, than it is on the flattened poles. Now, you have to remember that even as the Earth is being hurled through space, but even so, it's quite a delicate thing. You know, like Wisconsin is famous for logging. And if you have a log and you try to pull it from one place to another, the friction is enormous. However, I've done this. If you're in a lake, a huge log, you can actually walk up to it and move it because it's floating. And we've all done those kinds of experiments where you take a little duck in the bathtub and you go just like this with your hand at the water, and the waves move the little ducky all the way across the and it's that kind of sensitive system that the Earth in space has. It's spinning, and it's sensitive to a lot of different things. And the effect of it is that when the moon comes close to the equator, the Earth tilts. It tilts a little bit because of the pull of the Earth, of the moon, on the gravitational gravitational bulge at the equator. Now, when it tilts, two phenomena result from this, and both of them are important to astrology. but they're each important to a different part of astrology. Remember, we're talking about motions here having conscious meaning. What happens is when the Earth is tilting, instead of following it, it appears that instead of following its normal orbit, the moon seems to go like more directly upward. This is, again, extremely exaggerated, which means it gets to the equator before it would have gotten to the equator if the Earth hadn't tilted. And so the moon's nodes go backwards around the equator, and that's a cycle of about 19 years. But that's not the astronomical, astrological phenomenon we're interested in. We're interested in the other one. So when the moon goes north, it tilts the Earth. And then when it comes south, on the other side, it tilts the same way, only it's tilting it up rather than tilting it down, but it's the same direction. Now, it is a law of physics, it is called in torque mechanics, that if you produce a force, a circular force, at right angles to that circular force, you produce a vector force. And that vector force means that as the Earth tilts at right angles, the pole gets pulled out, so to speak. And it's just a very little bit, just for a few minutes during the entire cycle of the Earth, but there is that force pulling out. And this causes a wobble of the Earth. It's not like the wobble of a gyroscope, because a gyroscope has one axis stationary, but the whole thing is wobbling like that. But the wobble, because the effect is so tiny, is so slow, that one complete wobble of the Earth takes 25,868 years. That's a slow wobble. Now, we're trying to get the things here. Now, if this is the Sun, most of the planets are within a small band when they go around the Sun. The Sun is shaped like a flying saucer. And only two planets, Mercury and Pluto, get outside of this band very far. Mars gets out a little bit. And in this band, as the Earth is going around the Sun, it's not upright. It's inclined on its axis, 23 degrees, 21 minutes, and 26 seconds, or something like that, I think it is. This is something that you've all studied back in sixth grade. So we have the two motions here. On one hand, the Earth is spinning this way on its axis. At the same time and in the same direction that it is going around the Sun. But because it's always pointing at the same star, the North Star, somewhere way out here at infinity, it's always pointing at the same star, different parts of the surface are illumined. Like when it is exactly here, it's on the equator. So this is the vernal equinox. It's on the northern hemisphere. This is summer. This is winter. The Sun is pointing at the southern hemisphere. This is the autumnal equinox. And this is the vernal. Now, when the Earth is wobbling, it's wobbling the opposite direction. so that if at the vernal equinox, which is where things are measured from, when the sun is exactly on the equator of the earth, if you look behind it and there's a star behind it, behind the sun exactly, 72 years later, that star will not be behind the sun. It'll be a degree away from the vernal equinox. Because, mind you, the wobble is going this direction, and so the equinox will happen on a different place of the orbit. 72 years later, the equinox will not happen here. It'll happen here. And it'll be worked this way, backward around the zodiac. So this means that there is a constant changing of the astronomical conditions, and that there's a, behind the vernal equinox, there are different stars during the whole precessional cycle. It goes all the way through the entire zodiac. And it takes 25,868 years approximately. To go through one sign, that is through 30 degrees, it takes 2,156 years. And to go through 1 degree, it takes 72 years. And each year, the equinox precesses on the average about 50 seconds per year. Now, there are other kinds of movement. Oh, there's something. We're not done with that yet. There are other kinds of movements, like, for example, there is planetary precession that causes a deviation, and that produces another cycle that is, I got it in here, something like that, 40,000 years, I believe. It's a much longer cycle. All right. Now, we've already described the physics behind here, that this fits right in exact. This is why, this is what produces the movement. It is the precession. It's due to a gravitational effect. And mystics claim that there's something more to it, that it goes beyond the gravitational effect, because it changes, because the inclination of the orbit of the Earth changes, but that's something way beyond what we want to talk about. The effect here is changes in the entire environment, long-term environment, because right now, where we are in the precession of the equinox, we are closer to the sun in winter. At some stages, we will be closer to the sun in summer. And so it's constantly changing. In fact, this is something that is verified. What they do is they have gone to the Indian Ocean, and they've gone to a place where there have not been a lot of earthquakes and there have not been a lot of disturbances. And what they do is they take, I don't know how immense, it must be about 60 feet across, and they dig down and they take core samples. And they take core samples and they see what kind of soil is there. And they find, you know, that every so many hundred million years there's a reversal of the magnetic poles. You can find that actually in the soils. And what they do is they check the amount of oxygen 16 versus the amount of oxygen 14. And when the climate is extremely hot and mild, more of the oxygen 14 is tied up in plants. And so what they find out is they come over the curb, something that looks something like this. They don't know, have any idea why there are these extremely cold periods. They are, in terms of hundreds of millions of years, that the Earth is extremely cold. But all of these curves, the ups and downs, are exactly according to the precession of the equinox. When winter happens, when the sun is closest to the Earth, then it's a milder time. Winter time is the farthest from the Earth, it's a very, very cold time by comparison, but nothing compared to the other times. So this is something that there is evidence of, and it's evidence that scientifically goes back quite far. I was fortunate when the paper first came out talking about this whole study, I was fortunate there was, in the physics department, you were allowed to go to any seminars you wanted to go to, and they had one a week called the Astronomy and Space Physics Journal Group, and every week they would read a different paper. And when this paper first was delivered, I was one of the first people to hear it. It was really nice to find out about that. All right. What we're talking about, still not done with this yet. The consciousness effect is historical. That's what the whole of this class is about, or the whole of these series of talks. And this is the differences in zodiacs, is what happens as a result of the precession of the equinox. All right, that's about as technical as we're going to get tonight. Now we start talking about some of what this means. Now, we have to talk and we have to define some terms really clearly. Constellation. Con means together. Stellation means stars. The stella part is. So a constellation is a collection of stars grouped together. So the constellations are groups of stars that astronomers have said belong together with each other, and they go back very far in history. There are 50-some major constellations in the heavens, but they're of irregular sizes. And each constellation has a picture that's associated with it. Now, we need to talk about zodiac. The word zodiac literally means circle of animals. Zoos is where our word zoology comes from, and it's Greek for animal. Kaiko, or is the same as our word cycle. And so the iac, or is the cycle, is the cycle of animals. So a zodiac is a collection of either constellations or signs, usually portrayed as animals, through which the sun progresses every year in its orbital revolution. Now, we're talking only about visual astronomy. We're not talking about the origin of zodiacs, because mystics going way, way back have claimed that there were zodiacs before there were stars. Porphyry, the great Neoplatonist, said that there were that the whole zodiac, the dodecal form, was there before there was even the stars that we see in the sky. So it's not actually the sun that's going through the constellations. It is the Earth going around the sun, and it appears as though the sun is moving. Now, there are three distinct zodiacs, and this is a source of great confusion to people. And so we want to be as clear as we can be about it, because I've had all kinds of, usually with astronomers, the worst kinds of arguments with astronomers, because they don't listen to what you're saying. The first zodiac is a constellational zodiac, and it is comprised of all of the constellations through which, or the constellational areas through which, the sun passes. That is, there are 14 constellations through which the sun passes. It passes through the 12 constellations we normally speak of, and it passes through a corner of Orion, and it passes through a corner of Cetus. Now, a constellational zodiac is all the constellations are different sizes. Then there is a sidereal zodiac. A sidereal zodiac is an idealized constellational zodiac. It takes the constellations, it takes 12 of them, and it says they're all the same size, which means it's somewhat Procrustean. Some are going to be cut down a little bit, and some of them are going to be larger than they are in a pure constellational zodiac. The natural zodiac is another name for the sidereal zodiac. So we have two zodiacs. We have the constellational and we have the sidereal zodiac. The final kind of zodiac is called either the intellectual zodiac or the tropical zodiac. The tropical zodiac is from vernal equinox until the next vernal equinox. Doesn't make any difference what stars are behind it. The intellectual zodiac is called an intellectual zodiac because it is something that is in your consciousness. Now, we have to look at these in terms of effects, in what are called astrological effects. The fixed stars and constellations represent, in all forms of mysticism, foci of direct divine creative hierarchies, like it is a collection of divine beings that comes together as a constellation. Then things become tricky because fixed stars also affect different places and different kinds of events. Because each part of the world has a fixed star that passes over it, that is called a latitude star. And it affects everything, you know, if there's a latitude star for the city of Madison, everything that's on that latitude has that same star passing overhead. Used to be a very important thing, the leaning tower of Pisa used to be for looking at a latitude star. And right in the center of the towers like that for latitude stars was a hole right in the center, and you noted when the star of that latitude was exactly overhead. Fixed stars also have a lot to do with exact physical phenomena. For example, if you are working with astrology, there are certain fixed stars that produce events. In fact, if there is an astrological activity that's going on, like a conjunction or something like that, it's much more likely to produce an event if it is associated with a fixed star. The tropical or the sign zodiac or the intellectual zodiac is used for different purposes. It is used indirectly to be in touch with the divine hierarchies, but it is used more for discerning invisible psychological phenomena. It's not a physical thing. Just like the way an individual, the greater part of the individual is invisible, the greater part of the influence on human psychology is also invisible, and it is related to the intellectual or the tropical zodiac. However, again, there are exceptions. With the tropical zodiac, some physical things have to be done according to it. If you try to plant your seeds according to the sidereal zodiac, sometimes you're going to be planting in the middle of winter or you're going to be planting in fall and it doesn't work well. You plant your seeds when the sun is in tropical Taurus, not when it is in sidereal Taurus. So these are, you know, like, what I'm trying to say is that there are general things that each zodiac means. and each zodiac has its specific influence. All right. Is this clear so far as we've gone? Okay, because I don't know. Now, we want to get at the precession of the equinox. We want to get at what the relationship between the tropical zodiac and the constellational sidereal zodiacs, what that represents. Because as the equinoctial point moves through the different constellations or through the different idealized sidereal signs, there is a difference. All right. You know, the history changes, and it's really beautiful the way it changes. Now, all cycles in a time sense begin with Capricorn. Capricorn is the lord of time. In a material sense, all cycles begin with the vernal equinox and with the first degree of Aries. And since we are looking mostly at the exterior or the outer side of things, we're looking mostly at the first degree of Aries. And so this is meant to be, this diagram is meant to be the constellations lined up with the signs, lined up with the houses, everything in standard position. This is called an astrological mandala. Everything is in its classic standard position, and by understanding this, you can understand the entire cosmos. So what we're looking at is the beginning of the form, evolution of form, and so we begin always by working with the vernal equinoctial point. Now, in the horoscope, the ascendant, which is the beginning of the horoscope, represents the physical body. Aries represents the beginning of the year. It starts like a ram. It goes dashing forward. And so what we're looking at is as the equinoctial point changes, the exterior of the world in terms of history should change. No, we don't have enough blackboards, so we have to do some erasing here because we got a lot of more things to put up. What? All right. Let's look at some, let's make another table here. Let's look at the age of Cancer, which is called the Northern Gates. The cusp between Cancer and Gemini is called the Northern Gates. What we're saying is when the vernal equinox is passing through the constellation or the idealized sign idealized constellation Cancer is called the age of Cancer. And that is about 790 BC to 5800 BC. The age of Gemini is 5800, actually, obviously, to 3700. These are just rough numbers. And this is 3700 BC to about 1600 BC. The age of Aries is about 1600 BC to approximately 500 AD. And the age of Pisces is from approximately 500 AD to about 2600 AD. And the age of Aquarius is about 4700 to approximately 7000. No, I don't think so. Oh, yes. Yeah. This is the Southern Gates. This is 47 to approximately 7,000. Yeah, this one's 2,600. All right. I hate doing all the drawing on the board and such like that, and I get very impatient with it. Now, we have no historical records going back to the age of Cancer. The only thing that we have as an artifact is from the change between Cancer to Gemini was the last of the deluges of Atlantis. But it really isn't the same as the other deluges of Atlantis, which go way, way, way back in history. Hundreds of thousands or leading even to millions of years. But when the island of Poseidonis sank from the mid-Atlantic ridge, according to Plato and Solon, their time agrees pretty much with the transition from the Cancer to Gemini. The cultural, rough cultural effect of the Age of Gemini, for the most part, most of the people were gatherers and stalkers. Gemini rules the lizards, and we do have some artifacts going very far back into history that the Queen of Heaven or the King of Heaven was always drawn on a cart that was pulled by lizards. When we get to the Age of Taurus, the rough cultural was Taurus is a very drawn together. It was the clannish sign. It was the religion of the time was the religion of the bull, either of Mithra or of Aphis or of Brahma. All of those things were from the Taurian age. The esoteric side was from the opposite sign, and that was Scorpio. And there we have the Ophite Gnostics, or we have the Nagas, or the other having to do with serpent worship. The heroes, since Aries always represents the hero, in the age of Taurus, the heroes were the merchants. This is the time of Babylon. The people who were able to make a lot of money were the people who were looked up to as heroes. If we look at the architecture, we're looking at architecture where buildings were made with big, heavy, massive walls. When we come to the age of Aries, there was much more individualism. It is the age of rams. And the opposite sign is Libra, the sign of the law. And so this was a time of extreme individualism. The heroes were the champions who would stand for the whole army. And if we look at the architecture is like the outer body, the physical body of society. The architecture of the Age of Aries is extremely bold. It's extremely simple. It's something quite different than the period that preceded it. If we come to the Age of Pisces, the age we are now living in, what happened is there is a lot of martyrdom. There is a lot of living by belief. It's the age of blind faith. And it is the religion, is the religion of the fishes and of virgins. If we look at the heroes in the heart of this age of Pisces, it was all of the sea explorers like Vasco da Gama and places like that. If we look at the architecture, the societal architecture of the age of Pisces, we find like Gothic cathedrals that are woo-woo, mystical, and they've got all those ugly gargoyles and all of those things on it. And Pisces likes to lean a lot, especially on the bar. And so all of the churches had flying buttresses and things like that. We're now coming to the age of Aquarius. And the age of Aquarius, the consciousness will be more of an altruism or more of a universal brotherhood. We're becoming a one-world state very quickly. The religion is probably going to be humanism. And the esoteric religion is probably going to be Leonine. We already find exercises for that in a lot of religions, that as a person gains control, they gain control of the heart, and through the heart they gain control of the circulatory system. The heroes, we're already seeing heroes for the Aquarian age. For us, it's the scientists or the spacemen or people like that. And so that's all coming before us. The architecture, there's co-rulership of Aquarius, and the two co-rulers are Uranus, which makes things crystal clear, so we find a lot of glass architecture now, and obviously Saturn, old Saturn, loves the calcium, and it rules concrete, and so we're seeing all of the concrete architecture. So all of this holds together pretty well. We won't talk about the Capricorn age because that's so far ahead that it's beyond where our consciousness is. So we have a really rough idea of what we're looking at, how the ages change. Now, to get an exact positioning, these are very rough numbers, it's difficult. Because if you look in the heavens, there is no flashing light that says this is the first degree of Aries. There's not a big tape up there saying that this is the finish line or the beginning line. In fact, it's so difficult that this is where the controversial part comes in. So let's look a little bit at the whole business. All right, let's... This is Aries. This is the North Fish. This is the East Fish. This is the Water Bearer. Produces the river Eridanus, and down here is the big fish, the Pisces australis, the southern fish. Now, somewhere in here, a Pisces is a big constellation, and it overlaps with Aries. So where is the first degree? Very hard to tell this. Let's see, there's one star here, one star here, one star here, and one star here. They are the main stars in Aries. All right, we'll go through them. This is Al-Butain, which means the belly. It's in the belly of the... This is called Al-Hamail. The brightest star, it's Aries Alpha. It's called the forehead, Ram's forehead. This one here, Aries Beta, is called Al-Sharatan. And this one out here is called Mizraim. Do we have any more there? All right. on and on here, in this area, in this area of the zodiac is Fum Al Haut, which means eye of the fish. Now, astrology and history, an exceedingly difficult thing to do because there are so many astrological influences of so many different kinds going on, and they're all happening at the same time, that it's very hard to pick out specifics. There are planetary cycles. Like right now, we're approaching the height of the cycle of right-wingism. And 50 years from now, we'll be approaching the height of left-wingism. It goes, you know, then those are just due to planetary cycles. Then there are the ages, like what happens in the Aries age in this intellectualized sign of 2,156 years. How many, you know, what happens in there? If you divide it in half, what happens in the center? And then there are effects when the equinoctial point passes over fixed stars. The influences are subtle enough to pick up alone, to say nothing of all of the other kinds of influences of different varieties that are present at the same time. So a spiritual understanding of history and an astrological understanding of history is not at all easy. You have to have a perception so that you know what is causing what. What we just said about the different ages and the architecture and things like that, those are things that you can find and you can see, but they're rough. But to find out the specifics and to understand more clearly is not easy at all. All right, we're going to try to do that. Now, we want to do that because this is a controversial thing. We want to know when the time is. I happen to think that its approximation is good enough because it isn't like tile on a bathroom floor where one tile begins and another one ends. It's not a hard thing like that. Things in the spiritual world flow together. All right. The resources that I've used for putting these notes together, The History of Astronomy from Thales to Kepler, Simplified Scientific Astrology. For the India Astrology, I used Directions in New Era Astrology. For a lot of the historical things, Hamlet's Mill by Santillana and Dashund. And for the fixed star material, Star Lore, Star Names, Their Lore, and Their Meaning. And they are all by respected authors in their own fields. Obviously, Max Heindel, who wrote Simplified Scientific Astrology, is a respected mystic. And Iyer is a respected Hindu astrologer, another generation, the modern one. Modern Hindu astrologers are mostly Westerners. But that's another whole matter. All right. Let's start looking at fixed stars and let's pick out the influences of the age of Pisces in which we are now living that are associated to the equinoctial point or the whole coal year, equinoctial coal year passing over the various different stars. Aries Alpha is El Gemel. And you would expect that with the brightest star, there would be the brightest events. And there's no dispute about that, because at the time when the cold year was passing over there, six very remarkable people lived as contemporaries. I think it's even possible that all of them could have shaken hands with each other. The prophet Daniel, one of the Zoroasters, Pythagoras, Buddha, Lao Tzu, and Kung Fu Si, who we call Confucius, were all contemporaneous. And they were present at this time that the coal year was going over there. So this is something quite remarkable. At the time when it got, that was at El Jimil, I'm sorry, did I say El Sharatan? I meant to say El Jimil, the brightest star. By the time it got to El Sharatan, this was the glory time for Athens, when Plato and all of the great Athenian playwrights and such like that was when it was at Aries Beta. Mizraim is the time, close to the time when Jesus was there. We're saying that the equinoctial point is further east than there, because a lot of people like to say that the age of Aries began with Jesus, and that's just not the case. We'll come to that in just a little bit. Mizraim or Misartium is another name for it. It's sometimes called El Neith, which means the coming. And in Hebrew, it is called the Star of Jesher. And Jesher is the root from which Joshua comes, and it is the root from which Jesus comes. So the coming that it has talked about over thousands of years in history is talking about the coming that was associated with the ram's horn. Now, I will not say that Mizraim is the star of Jesus. In one way, in terms of the procession of the equinox, it is. But the star of Jesus is an internal phenomenon, and that the star that is talked about in the Gospels is something that is inside of yourself, and it has nothing to do with the stars outside, except that there are correspondences like this. This is quite clear because Joshua blew on the ram's horn, and they entered into the promised land. And so the promise that is coming now is the promise of a whole new era. And so what did Jesus say? He said he was called the Lamb of God, but he said he was making fishers of men out of people. So this is what it is, what's called that here. Some of this information you can get out of a book called Witness of the Stars by a man called Bullinger. All right, now we know where specific things happen. But in the age of Pisces, for example, one of the more prominent stars in the constellation of Pisces is Diphta. And Diphta, going all the way back, if you read from Claudius Ptolemy's Almagest, Diphta is a Saturnine star. And at the time, or very near to the time, when the equinox was near Diphta, Saturn and Mercury conjoined with each other. And so you'd expect something very Saturnine, something very concentrated. And this was the birth of Albert Einstein, who was Pisces, and with his Pisces-like qualities, had that whole floaty idea of relativity. So there are those kinds of things. Let's see. All you need is a good scientific, programmable, hopefully, calculator, and a book of history, and sit down with an astronomy book, and you can sit down with a calculator, and you can find all sorts of things like this. They're quite fascinating. When I have time, it's something that I like to do. I'd like to do a lot of other things. All right, let's see. I've got some more things in the notes here. By now, I'm far away from the notes. Then there is the precession of the solstitial coal year, which is much more esoteric. And this is the one that everybody, all the New Agers, are talking about now, because the solstitial coal year is just about to conjoin with the center of the Milky Way galaxy, with the black hole that is in the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And that is considered, first person I found that has written about that was Rudolf Steiner, gave an essay on, oh boy, I forget the name of it. And I let the book get out of my hands, but I'm sure you could find it on the website. You know, that has everything on there. Just key in solstitial coal year, and he'll give his take on it. saying that very dramatic changes in evolution occur at the time when it lines up with the center of the Milky Way galaxy. I forget, I think it's something about occult influences or something like that is the name of the talk. Oh boy, well, I had some other good information here I wanted to go into. Now, we said that Indian astrology is sidereal astrology, but Indian astrology makes corrections. And they make a correction for the difference from the beginning of the sidereal zodiac to the current position of the vernal equinox. And the name for that difference is Ayanamps. If you're a Westerner, you would say Ayanamsma. Ayanamas. Ayanamsa. It's pronounced the A, but they don't pronounce the A, and they're very hard to predict. Now, that is what they use as a correction factor to make up for the differences between the two zodiacs, because they don't do only fixed star things. They do psychological things, too. Not so much at all as in the West, but unfortunately, there are four different Ayanamps in India. And they're all fairly close to each other. And the one that we're using is the one that is closest, just a little bit east of Mizoram. Now, the reason I have chosen this one is because it goes along with spiritual students. It is the one, for example, that the Babylonian astrologers used for making all their predictions. It is also the one that was used by the mystical astronomer Tycho de Brahe. He had his whole angelology, and it was laid out according to the sidereal zodiac in relation to the tropical. And his starting point was near what is called the Chitta Ayanamps. So this is Madame Blavatsky, Max Heindel, and I believe Rudolf Steiner, though I'm not positive on that, Rudolf Steiner used the same starting point of the zodiac as being right in there. All right.
And that was called?
The Chitta. There, in modern sidereal astrologers like Cyril Fagan do something altogether different. They take it to be on the axis with the star Diphta, which is in the opposite constellation of Virgo, but he was barely sane, I tend to think. Have you ever read any Cyril Fagan? Oh, okay. All right. According to this, the age of Pisces would begin at 498 AD. Now, you would expect something eventful would happen at that time. There was exactly an event that describes the change from the age of Aries to the age of Pisces that happened in 496 AD. And that was the Second Council of Nicaea, that little city in Turkey where they used to have those councils. And it was at this council that Catholicism, especially under the direction of one of my very favorite people, Saint Augustine, became what it is now. And at that council, all of everything that came from the age of Aries, all of the Orphics like Pythagoras and Plato and all the Gnostic wisdom was declared heresy. And basically what you had then was the beginning of the Dark Ages. And I think that is the defining event for the beginning of the age of Pisces. I think it was an important thing to do because Christianity was so radically new. We don't even begin to know what the new Christianity is yet. And if it had been tied too closely to the ancient philosophies, the newer facets of it would not have come out. It's one of those things that you don't You try to associate things with things from the past. And if you have something completely new, you have to let it stand out for itself alone, or you get tied down that way. So according to using this point, it would be in about the year 2654, that the Aquarian Age would be exactly beginning. I don't like exact beginnings, and because things flow into one another. Actually, we got within orb of the Aquarian Age in the mid-19th century, and that is when the whole leftist philosophy began, and leftist thinking is very Aquarian. Everybody is all equal, and at that same time, it was the beginning of the Romantic period. Romanticism in all of the arts forms began in the mid-19th century, and so that's what we're talking about. If we take the point east of Mizraim as the beginning of it, then it would mean that the center of the Age of Pisces would be in the heart of the Renaissance, or the heart of the Renaissance, depending on. And it's very interesting that the beginning of the Rosicrucian movement, according to Max Heindel, that began at 1313, but it was certainly in gear by 1344, which is exactly when the equinox went over Alganeb, which is the brightest star in the constellation of Pisces. So that kind of esoteric thing that began to change away from the dark ages of Pisces began at that time when the Rosicrucians were born out of the Johannites after the Crusades. So if this may be a disappointment, because many of you want to be living at the beginning of the Aquarian Age, but if you work very hard on your spiritual exercises, you can come back much more quickly, and everybody can come back to be here for the beginning of the Aquarian Age if they want to do it. There's a lot of activity. Probably the brightest period of the Aquarian Age will be when the coal year gets to Fomalhaut, which is one of the brightest stars in the heavens, and it forms part of the four corners. And the four corners are Aldebaran, the brightest star of Taurus, Regulus, the brightest star in Leo, Antares, which is the brightest star in Scorpio, and Fomalhaut, the brightest star in the constellation of Aquarius. The ancient Persians used to have a zodiac that was based on those four corner stars. The thing that is very, very interesting is that at the same time that the vernal coal year will be at Fomalhaut, the solstitial coal year will be at Antares, because they are roughly 90 degrees apart. And in terms of spiritual history, if there are going to be brilliant, brilliant advances, that's the time it'll probably occur. And that would be about at the time 38:50. We don't talk about tomorrow. It's almost absurd the numbers get so large. So, all right, you can see what we're talking about. We're talking about the Aquarian Age. We're talking about a very slow ramping up or changing to that time. Let's talk just a very few seconds about what the Aquarian Age is not. It is not the New Galilee. It is not the Galilean epoch. That is when all humanity will be totally as one, and there are still too many differences, racial and religious, and people think way too much in terms of individualism, and some people haven't even come to individualism yet, for the Galilean epoch to be. It is not the dissolution of the earth or the second coming. No one knows that, at least according to Christ in the Bible. Some people have guessed, both Steiner and Heindel have guessed, that that would be at the far end of the Aquarian Age at about 4810. I happen to disagree with that, but Madame Blavatsky thinks that the end of the Kali Yug occurs at about 4810. This is where you get the information that she used Chitta Anyasam. It is definitely, most definitely, not the last judgment that determines who can continue forward as human beings becoming angel-like. That is a very long way off, and that's in another cosmological revolution. So what we're saying is the dawn of the Aquarian Age is 1850. The hard start is 2654. The heart of it is 3234. Fomalhaut is at 3850. And roughly speaking, the dawn of the Age of Capricorn is at 4000. The end of the hard start of the Age of Capricorn would be at about 4810. And the very end of the Age of Capricorn would be at 6966. And the reason I bring this up is because the other major source, who I happen to agree with, for the time of the Second Coming and the dissolution of the Earth is at the year 7000, and that's Nostradamus. So at the other end of the Age of Capricorn, the reason for that is in going throughout all cosmic history, the southern gates and the northern gates are when all evolutionary changes occur, major ones, and so when the equinox gets to there, that would be seem to be the time that the that would mark the difference. If at this point in the sidereal zodiac was when the great flood occurred, and it was how does the Bible say it? And the folk song says it: no more water, but a fire next time, and that would be when it passes into Sagittarius. That seems the most likely to me, but that's even more speculative. All right, we're now ready to go into the subject of the Aquarian Age. And next time we meet, 2 weeks from now, the talk will be called The Holy Grail and the Aquarian Age in Heaven and Earth, and bring along cushions, because it's probably the best talk of the whole bunch to get the feel of the history of it, but it's long, and it could run as long as 2 hours. And then the one after that is a cream puff lecture. So.